Welcome to the Super Lead Podcast, which is all about expanding your personal and leadership capacity, inspiring you to go further in leading yourself, your families, your teams, and your organizations. And here's your host, Manda Chitlaro.
Hello and welcome to episode 81 of the Super Lead Podcast series. Thank you for tuning in to our weekly podcast featuring my interviews with African super leaders. On this channel, we interview individuals who are leading in the private sector, be it startups or corporate, in the public sector, as well as in civil society. We also interview business consultants, speakers, experts, scientists, thought leaders, just to name those few. These interviews are packed with insightful, inspirational, and actionable leadership and personal development content. And our aim is to stretch your personal and leadership capacity so you can reach your full potential and make a positive impact in the lives of others. And as we collectively do, our African continent is better for it. So after listening to this phenomenal episode, I will really encourage you to also check out our previous 80 episodes. You can find these on our website at www.superlead.co.za, on iTunes Podcast or Deezer, and on Spotify podcast channels. I will also encourage you to share this podcast with those you believe will be inspired by this interview. So for today's podcast, we discuss what many leaders are faced with, having to turn around the companies that they lead, be it small, medium, or even large corporates. Most organizations are still battling with the effects of this pandemic. Stephen Van Coller is delivering on that promise of turning around one of the most iconic, proudly South African organizations, and that is EOH. So I interviewed him to tap into his playbook for turning around EOH so we can all learn from his journey. So here it is, my conversation with Stephen Van Coller. Take a listen.
So Stephen, welcome to Super Lead Podcast.
Thank you very much. It's really good to be here and thanks for the invitation.
Excellent. As I said, I am super amped to have you with us today. So we will dive straight in. So today, many organizations, leaders are faced with having to turn around the companies that they lead, be it small, medium size, even large corporates. You know, most organizations are still battling with the effects of the pandemic crisis. And maybe some of the challenges we face, especially as a country, before even the pandemic. But you delivering on the promise of turning around one of the most iconic, proudly South African organizations. So we want to tap into that playbook, Stephen's playbook for turning around this organization, and so we can all learn. But before we do that, we want to learn from your journey of leadership excellence. And we like to ask all our guests to kind of walk us through your journey, start as early as you can remember. And, you know, you will hit a few milestones here and then in some synthesized manner to where we are as group CEO at EOH.
Yeah, thanks very much. I mean, it's been a long journey. The interesting thing was, you know, when I was on my way to university, I wanted to get a bursary to try and help pay for the studies. I think that's, you know, most students' issues is finding the money to go and study. In those days, IBM ruled the world. Anyway, afterwards, I decided not to apply for the bursary because I thought there was no future in computers. So it's just very interesting that, you know, I've now gone full circle. But I suppose that the point of it is that you're not always going to make perfect decisions. Sure. And as Alex Ferguson once said, is the best decision is a good decision, but the worst decision is no decision. And so rather just make decisions, because you can always change bad decisions. You can't change no decision. And it's one thing I've sort of learned over time is don't be scared to make the wrong decision. Sure. Just make a decision and then deal with it. And if it was the wrong one, change it, you know. But I tend to stay fairly long in companies for whatever reason. But I always move around and do different jobs, you know. I was after my articles, you know, I ended up coming back to South Africa and then spent 10 years at Deutsche Bank, 10 years at Absor, Barclays Africa. In those times, there's some very interesting things that, you know, happen to you. And as I say, life's a journey, not a destination. You need to move through it without too much fixed ideas. I mean, I never had an idea that I'd ever be a CEO. I thought that was way beyond me, to be quite frank.
Sure.
But the opportunity came when I was at Absa, and I thought, well, this is going to push me out of my comfort zone. Yeah. Let me go and see, you know, how this feels. And it did. It pushed me very much out of my comfort zone.
Yeah.
And I suppose a few lessons I've learned, you know, I'm very much A-type personality. So I want to do everything myself, and, you know, and that's how I started. And I learned very quickly that if you hire the best people, it's a bit silly not to listen to them because they're the best people.
Yeah.
So rather take a bit longer to hire people, make sure they're the right people, and then listen to them. Spend a lot of time listening before you make decisions.
Yeah,
and
I love
that. In my experience, I've thrown a lot of people in the deep end.
Yeah.
I've had very few disappointments. You know, even at EOH, my starting point was that 99% of the people really just wanted to do an honest day's business, wanted to work hard, wanted to succeed, and wanted some assistance and direction.
Yeah.
And if you start with that attitude, you tend to get a much better result out of it. I suppose at Deutsche Bank, what was when I started at Deutsche Bank, what was interesting, two things.
Yeah.
One is I nearly left Deutsche Bank after a few years because the world changed.
Yeah.
And I went looking for another job rather than looking internally.
Yeah.
And at the last minute, I decided to write the CEO at the time a letter to say, this is who I am, or email. This is who I am. This is my skills.
Yeah.
Here's what I think you're doing wrong in the business in terms of, you know, possibilities.
Yeah.
He has three things that I think if we did, we could actually make good money out of.
Yes.
And in order of preference and to my skills, these are the things I'd want to do. And what was interesting, it wasn't just providing the problem. I actually provided the solutions.
Wow.
And that's what resonated. He actually called me on a Sunday night and said, well, thanks for your letter. I think this is what I want you to do. He didn't give me my number one, but he gave me my number two. And to be quite frank, the rest is history. I very quickly became a managing director. I ended up running the private side of the business. It just taught me that in life, 90% of problems are miscommunication. The other thing I learned, which was, you know, very helpful, was it was the early days of BE and having to, you know, get the right mix of skills and everything.
Yeah.
At my age, I grew up in a white school. I grew up in segregation. I wasn't going to bras with mixed, you know, races and that. I was lucky enough to have been a football or soccer player. So at least I had friends that I respected and I, you know, saw them as equals. And I think maybe that helped.
Yeah.
But in this whole drive, the one thing I did wrong is I didn't spend the same amount of time interviewing and recruiting people in the beginning of color.
Yeah.
And that ended up with me having to get rid of them, 50% of them, 2 or 3 years later.
Sure.
And I felt like I was a failure because I hadn't recruited the right people. And interestingly, when I was at Absa, one person I went and recruited, two people, one was Pachamani Khadebe. You may have known him. He was the DDG at National Treasury, was the CEO at Land Bank, did great work there.
Yeah.
But we were quite different people, and we made so much progress because I had someone who thought totally different from me. It just shows you, if you go and hire these people that think differently, push your boundaries, you actually do a much, much better job. So for me, getting the gender and the race, you know, diversity in an exco, in a board, has become a fundamental for success.
And I like the fact that this nuance that you add, which is you take time to interview them and make sure that they're right people. And it's not just very quickly bring people that look different, because then that's got consequences in the end.
Yeah. And I think, you know, what I learned also from Pachamani was you've got to get real people to do real jobs. So when I got into the EOH situation and I had to clean up management, clean up the board, I made an absolute point of going to hire real people. And if you look at our board now, I think it's 70% black, 50% woman.
Yeah.
And I don't think there's a single, in my personal view, there's a single person on there that if you go through their names, they haven't achieved in their life.
Yeah.
And these are largely people older than me. But now we've got real diversity of thought. We have real debates.
Yeah.
And it's one of the reasons why we succeed. I did the same with my executive committee.
Yeah.
I had to get a new executive committee. I've got a balance of skills. We've got a good balance of male and female. I think reporting to me, there's 4 males, 4 females. I think there's 4 black, 4 white.
Wow.
Being a white male changed the balance slightly, but I'm just saying this is the team of people that have done the turnaround. I mean, I couldn't have done it on my own. It's too complex, too big, too timely. And I suppose the one learning is spend time looking for people. The talent is out there, I can tell you. They're everywhere.
Don't
do it yourself because, you know, I'm a white male chartered accountant and I think I'm reasonable at my job. I'll probably go and hire other white male chartered accountants just because that's what I recognize. And if you do it that way, you don't get the diversity, you don't get the diversity of thought, the challenge, you know, and you need that when you go into battle.
No, that's fantastic. That's such good insights. The both of us have worked at MTN. You had a beautiful career there as well.
Yeah, listen, MTN was great for me. It's a brilliant business. You know, the two must start that business some time ago. And if there's one leader I look up to, it's him. He's just the most amazing broad thinker, forward thinker. I've had a lot of counsel from him over time. I still speak to him today. He was my customer for nearly 20 years, both in his Pembani guys as well as his MTN guys. You know, I think he's just one of those true leaders you want to, you know, listen to. But going there out of banking, it's quite interesting. I spent 10 years at Deutsche Bank, 10 years at Barclays Africa or ABSA. And I've got this 10-year thing about, you know, a job. It just, you need to move on. And I remember thinking, the last thing I want to do is retire one day and think all I was a banker. So, and I had that same thing was, you know, I did a CA and I didn't want to, every time I filled in a visa form or something, have to put the accountant. So I wanted to be something else, you know. And then I got over banker and I wanted to be something more. But it's a brilliant, you know, place to learn. I learned so much about the sort of bottom end of retail, the LSM 1-6, how important they are to society, how important they are to the world, how much more we can get out of them if we just gave them social and financial inclusion. And it was the main reason why I went there for the mobile money. We created an ecosystem.
Yeah.
We were starting with the behavioral economics. They're doing a great job.
Yeah.
It was a pity. I disagreed with the, we had a board approved strategy. And when the new CEO came in, we, you know, between him and I, we disagreed with the strategy.
Yeah.
And I just didn't feel it was right for me to try and drive something I didn't, you know, feel comfortable with.
Yeah.
And he was the CEO. He's far more important than me at that space. So, you know, I said to him, I'll do a proper handover, hire the people and I'll move on.
Yeah.
And it was all amicable, but I would have loved to have stayed there for longer because companies like that can really make a difference to the whole social inclusion across the continent.
Yeah.
And I do believe that Africa, with its next billion, is going to be very important in the global economy.
Absolutely. And then you went to your age.
You're laughing as you say that.
I mean, I don't know if they told you that what you were walking into, and the fact that a year or so later you will have to lead this organization through a crisis. I just wonder what happened for you to say yes to that offer letter.
Yeah, listen, it's very interesting. As I was a little bit naive, you know, I'd come from big business.
Yeah.
And big business has lots of power. It's like an oil tanker. You can turn the steering wheel in an oil tanker, but it takes 3 or 4 kilometers before it actually starts turning because it's just the power it drives through.
Yeah. You know,
some people say these big businesses do well despite themselves. And so there were just some things that I just assumed would be there that weren't there. You know, my career has always been fixing and building just because of any other reason, but that's, you know, how it turned out. And I loved what they were doing. I'd been looking for a job that could make a difference. You know, I'd been very privileged to be at Deutsche Bank and Barclays. I'd done very well out of it.
Yeah.
But I felt, I'd always said, when I get to 50, I want to try and add value and, you know, give something back.
Yeah.
And I started that at MTN and the mobile money and broadening that and bringing financial inclusion,
yeah.
You know, with the the team, as well as, you know, everything else we were doing in the digital space with digital education and that. And then they came and asked me to professionalize EOH. And one of the things that really attracted me to it is when I spoke to a lot of my customers, they said that, you know, EOH produced very good work for them, highly skilled, very intelligent, very broad-based, very end-to-end in the ICT spectrum. Yeah. And I'll come back to that in a minute. But they also had a youth development program that was massively successful. Yeah. It was taking youth and it was training them in ICT. And they had something like, and I'll get the number slightly wrong, but it's in the ballpark, something like an 87% success rate in getting jobs.
Yeah.
And they put like 12,000, you know, kids through it.
Yeah.
And this really attracted me. And the second thing was, you know, our new president had come in and he had this focus on the fourth industrial revolution.
Yes.
And this was going to be the center of what he wanted to do in South Africa. And I just thought, sitting at EOH, there's so much I could add to that.
Yeah.
And so all these luck bits, you know, fitted together. What I totally underestimated was that the company, from a head office perspective, had been run so badly. It was basically heading towards bankruptcy. They'd borrowed too much money. They'd made some very bad acquisitions.
Yeah.
Hadn't realized, but they'd stolen nearly R1 billion. A small group of people at head office put near, you know, a whole lot of money into some bad acquisitions. And they just had no support functions. There was no internal audit. There was one person in compliance for 10,000 people.
No way.
There was no risk function. It was, you know, unbelievable. But what I didn't realize at the time was the systemic bribery and corruption from a small group of people sitting at head office.
Yeah.
I think what saved us was the fact that it was an aggregation of a whole lot of really good ICT businesses.
Yeah.
And so, you know, with the corruption being at head office, it was quite easily to cut it out. It's a bit like, you know, having cancer of, you know, of your arm or something. You can cut your arm off and the rest of the body, you know, survive.
Yeah.
And so we were very lucky when we went in and had a look at it. I saw that there was a chance of survival.
Yeah.
And, you know, I took a lot of counsel from, you know, Rothschilds, from Edward Nathan, from, you know, people, even, you know, Patuma at the time.
Yeah.
And it was a tough decision, but the decision was, you know, there's 10,000 jobs here. We need to save them if we can, because, you know, we're systemic to South Africa. We sit in the middle of all the financial institutions. We sit in Home Affairs, SASSA, the big metros. If we this whole thing folds, it's going to be a problem. And that was the sort of driving force of it, to be quite frank. You know, sometimes in bad days, you sort of look back and go, you know, should I have really done that? Or should I have just sort of thrown in the towel? But listen, I've learned an enormous amount. I've been very fortunate to assemble just a really amazing team who, you know, has come in knowing that there were problems. You know, just about everyone I've hired knew there were problems.
Yeah.
But they come, and I've even had people phoning and asking to assist. So you end up with a great culture in the business. It's just been the most amazing team effort. You know, if I look back at everything I've done, there's almost not a single employee who hasn't had to put their shoulder to the wheel, work massively hard, take pay cuts, not get bonuses, to pay back the money that other people stole. It's like almost having to take over your dad's debt or something like that. So you have to work for the next 10 years hard and get no benefit from it, even though you're working hard and all that money has been spent. And so it's my sort of small gripe against capitalism and these legal structures. There must be a better solution to the world. But yeah, I mean, so it's been quite important.
So you inherited 272 legal entities within your age, with all sorts of problems you highlighted. Where would anyone start? The legal structures, how do you even look at this income statement and the balance sheet? Where do you even, the people, the systems, the processes? I'm keen to know when all of this is presented to you, say, all right, calm down, everyone. This is our process. We're going to start there. We're going to move there. We're going to go there. Because I imagine most people having to turn around their businesses or the divisions wherever they are, you know, the problems are thrown at them every other meeting. Maybe they probably need to step back and say, all right, let me read Steven's playbook to turn around a company. This is where I'm going to start.
It's a really interesting way of putting it. You're exactly right. It's simple. If you read it in a textbook, it's not straightforward when you do it.
Yeah.
And I think I was a little bit lucky, obviously, in the bank and that to have been through some crises. And the one thing that we had done when we were at ABSA, when the Reserve Bank had been checking all the FICA, you know, things, you know, when you've got 12 million customers, you can't go and sort out all the past 12 million because you're putting, you know, a few thousand customers on every single day. And so you need to split things into the past and the future. And the first thing you need to do is make sure that everything you're doing from this day forward is right. And then you can go and sort out the past.
That's
if you start sorting out the past and you don't sort out your processes, you're just adding more problems to the pile. And so you never get there. I don't know if that makes sense. But so you split the future from the past. You make sure you put in the right processes. So everything, and doesn't happen overnight, but I'm saying you work out what you need for the future, and then you start that process, and then you start delving into the past. We were in a slightly different situation in that as a services business, I could lose my customers very quickly. So I knew I needed to understand the problems very quickly.
Yeah.
I needed to be totally transparent because it had already been put in the press by the whistleblower. There wasn't an ability for me to do it under wraps, finish it, you know. I had to, everyone knew about it and they were waiting to see. Fortunately, you know, I'd come with some reputation. So I was able to go and speak to all the customers who were customers of mine when I was at, you know, Barclays Africa and say to them, listen, this is what I'm doing. This is what the process is. Here's the timeline. And most of them gave me the benefit of the doubt and said, okay, if you do all that, then we'll come back and we'll be customers. And so I had to do it fast and quick. And we did, you know, in 6 months, we did our report, I think on July the 16th. I think the Microsoft whistleblower was the 10th of February. So between the 16th of, or between the 10th of February and 16th of July, 2019, I needed to tell people what I knew. And so that was the first bit. And then I had to get, you know, so that was getting the credibility back. And at the same time, hired someone to put in the systems and make sure our business going forward was clean.
Yeah.
And Fatima Newman came in. She was actually at MTN. She was also at Barclays Africa and has done a most amazing job. And we can talk a little bit about that, but that was important. The second thing was to make sure that we had money. We had liquidity. because of all the money that was stolen, the big debt and everything, is how do you make sure that you've got money? As they say, you know, something like revenue is vanity, profit is sanity, and cash is reality.
and
that's one thing I think everyone must learn. I'd never had to do it in big businesses. But the first thing I did is we went back to running the business by the bank account. I didn't care what the accounts told me. I wanted to see how much money was in the bank every single day. If it went down, I wanted to know why. And if it went up, I wanted to know why. And that's how we learned about the business. It was really about going back to basics. And, you know, today I get daily cash flow. I get weekly working capital, so debtors, creditors, reports. And you can manage quickly. And I think this is one of the reasons why we did so well through COVID, is we had all these things in place.
Jeez.
And then the third thing was, once you've done the credibility, you've now got your liquidity and you're paying the banks down and you've got a plan. And the third thing was having an investable strategy that investors could understand, because EOH was notoriously murky. And so we had to go and do our bottom-up strategy so that all the staff bought into it. They believed in it. It wasn't just Stephen Mancola saying, this is what EOH is going to do. Actually, the people who were going to execute it actually knew what they were doing and how they were going to do it. And that was really important, because then everyone knows you're going from Cape to Cairo. They don't know quite how you're getting there, but they know the first leg, but everyone knows their bit. And so those three things were critical. And we've stuck to that. If you have a look at all our reports and everything today, we still categorize it like that. And part of it then was, in this whole liquidity, credibility and everything, you have to simplify the business. And I liken it to having 272 speedboats with no two-way communication. So once they got in the water, it was like the 100 meters for people with no sense of direction. They just went all in their own direction. And the problem with that is every boat's got a captain, every boat's got a pilot, every boat's got an engineer, every boat's got a driver, and so you duplicate a lot. And this was, you know, you talk about reducing the entities. We've gone from 272, we're below 150 at the moment. I don't want to get to one big oil tanker that's totally unagile, but I want to get to something like your, you know, 40 frigates with two-way communication, can all run their own speed, but actually work together in unison to win the battle. And so this is, you know, this is the vision that we're on at the moment.
Excellent. So that process at a personal level, I wonder how you sustain emotionally when you have to cut 81 companies that are part of the family that wear the same t-shirt. If it were, let's start, say, September 2018. I don't think anyone has given you a break to say, okay, Stephen, maybe take 2 weeks off or 3 weeks off. Because I think you started the turnaround and then you had the crisis. How do you as a leader sustain that level of high engagement in the turnaround and crisis?
Yeah, listen, it's difficult, but you've got to believe in your plan. You know, it is. It's very energy sapping, but it helps if you've got good people around you, because then you're not doing everything. You know, one thing I've learned out of time is you must tell people what you want. Don't tell them how you want it. Let them work out how to do it. And it's amazing the ingenuity and the different ways of doing things. And people love that ownership. You know, as long as they know they're doing the right thing, you don't tell them how to do it, they'll do a good job generally. That's the first thing. Yeah. The second thing is you need to find counsel. You need to have people you can talk to. You need to have people who can give you views. I found that quite a bit on my board, you know, going and finding people who've been through tough lives, you know, tough, you know, business situations. They've actually learned it. So don't try and reinvent the wheel. Go and find those people and then, you know, get their counsel, because it just makes it so much easier.
Yeah.
The last thing, the most important thing, is be totally transparent.
Sure.
Because you're not going to get everything right all the time.
Yeah.
But if you accept up front, you're going to make some mistakes. When you do make them, it's actually not that emotional. It's like driving to work. If you get upset every time a taxi cuts you off, you're going to be upset every time you drive to work. But if you know a taxi is going to cut you off, when they cut you off, you go, oh, there's another one. And it doesn't stress you out, because you know it's going to happen. Does it make sense? And so it was the one thing I learned when I was CEO of CRB at Barclays Africa or ABSA.
Yeah.
You know, I was 42. I was really wanting to get everything right. But the biggest lesson I learned is that as the CEO, you never finish. Every day there's a new problem. Just get used to it. You must walk into your office and say, okay, what's my problem today? The thing I have to solve for. What's the thing that's come from left field? And if you have that attitude, it just comes and it's something you do and you sort it out and you move on. And you've got to have that attitude, because otherwise it's very, very stressful. And at the end of the day, you're doing a job, you're getting to a point, and you need to just get it done.
Excellent. So organization-wise, so these 272 legal entities, they're coming down, but then you started to organize them into IOCO and Nextech and IP, and they're not all at a turnaround phase. Maybe just talk a bit about the strategy approach with the sort of different sectors.
Yeah, I fundamentally believe that, you know, a business is an ecosystem. You know, it's like if you have to fight a war, you don't go in with yourself. You know, you go in as a group of people, and maybe you have three or four companies working together, trying to, you know, surround the enemy or whatever you want to do. There's a great book by Nassim Taleb called Fooled by Randomness. And one of the most profound statements he makes in there, and he talks about anti-fragility. You need to build a business that's anti-fragile. And this is what people in COVID have found, you know, if you were using lots of debt to, you know, zoom your margins, you probably lost your business because you were totally fragile. If something went wrong, it killed the business. And this is what he says. He says, probability doesn't matter. If that event happens, it kills you. It might happen only once in 25 years. But if that one event is going to put your business at risk, you should never allow it to happen. And so one thing you do as you create these bigger business, or these frigates, as I called them, is you start putting more than one line of business together. You start putting more customers together. You allow that group of businesses to go to the same customer once, give them a Mr. Delivery menu as opposed to just the Steers menu, you know. Yeah. So there's more chance of you winning more business if you're giving them more options. Put the businesses into their natural packages. Okay. So we've got a services business that does managed connectivity, managed infrastructure, and that's a number of businesses. We've got a technology business that does software and hardware, you know, puts it together and delivers it to you. And then I've got what I call almost the four-hour business, which is doing all the new age stuff, the move to the cloud, the data analytics, the security, you know, things like that. And if you put them in bigger blocks, they're actually far more useful. It's like, you know, if you went into MTN to buy a cell phone and all you could do was buy the screen, and you have to go to the next shop to buy the battery and the next shop to buy the cover and the next shop, I mean, you'd go crazy. And this is how small businesses end up operating. They're just doing one little sliver of the whole ecosystem. And so we did the whole process, understanding the ecosystem, removing duplication, having a proper go-to-market, rather than being a product push, let's solution for our customers. Let's give them the outcome they want, that, you know. If you think about Facebook, you don't know what technology is behind it. You don't care what cloud it's on, what programming language. You just want the outcome. You want to put a picture on it. You want to send it to your friends. As long as it works, you're happy. And this is where technology is going. And so this is what we're repurposing EOH into.
Then there's cost restructuring. That process in its own, I think, emotional, it's tough. Some jobs are impacted. I wonder how perhaps you have had to think and kind of approach the managing of cost.
So I fundamentally believe that digitization is actually going to allow us to work less, but work more efficiently. And we've seen it a bit in COVID. All of a sudden, because of digital, you can work at home and not spend an hour in the traffic every day. So suddenly you've got an extra hour to either spend with your family, your dogs, your whatever. And I think this is exactly what's happening. And so if you can digitize your work, you can actually get people to spend more time doing meaningful stuff. And actually using their brain for 75% of the time, not 25% of their time, and then 75% doing admin. My disappointment is that I was in survival mode. You know, we had to pay down 4 billion of debt, which we're now down at 2 billion. And this means you have to do things in an emergency mode. You know, it's like you have to sell one of your cars because you can't afford both of them. But it means that now you've got inefficiencies of, you know, getting to work because you both go in one car and you've got to drive a longer route, et cetera, et cetera. And I do think that corporate world generally needs to have a bigger thing about reskilling. I've got a, you know, fundamental belief. Our minimum wage in South Africa is probably half of what it needs to be to have a decent life. But you can't pay people twice unless they double their productivity. And they can't double their productivity unless you train them. And so what we're trying to do is we're trying to make sure that we are upskilling staff. So it doesn't matter even if you are the tea lady. If you want to become a Java developer, you can.
Excellent.
Go and train yourself. And it's part of your KPIs. I mean, we had a great success in ABSA CRB where we had this academy, and it actually started out of trying to find more black traders. We couldn't find them. They didn't exist really. But we found the skills sitting in our finance department. They understood exactly all the convexity and the options and, you know, everything. And they were actually good enough to be traders because they understood the maths. But because of a career path, they'd ended there. And so we started a CRB Academy, and it went from having 16 people to 93 people when I left. But we actually had a secretary who went on the course and became an FX trader. You know, and so, I mean, that's obviously one example, but it is possible. You know, people end up in jobs that maybe don't suit them because of their backgrounds or where they came from. And actually, if you allow them to upskill themselves and part of their job, it's amazing what you get out of people.
Excellent. So I know from your integrated report that you're building a values-based, sustainable organization, you know, from a societal perspective. You're building technology skills in communities, taking action in climate change. And the third one is you're eliminating corruption. I'm interested to hear some lessons, if you could share what you've learned in that process of rooting out corruption in a hugely complex vaccine organization? And I think in this case, it was sort of localized.
Yeah, listen, long term, there's only one way to do business, and it's the right way. You know, you need to have a view. It's quite interesting. When I was at the World Economic Forum, I went to two talks. One was by the founder of Lego. And I don't know if you know, but Lego is probably a, I don't know, 75-year-old family business. They professionalized it. But the point is that if you know that you're going to hand over this business to your kids, would you put it at risk?
Sure.
Would you, how would you deal with your staff?
Sure.
Would you be, you know, short-termism, a bit like a listed company where you're trying to do half your results, so everything's about the next half? Or do you do things for the long term? And Paul Polson of Unilever has been a prime example of creating this long-term vision. And just to give you another one, I was at a function where they had a stall. I don't know if you know, but the most expensive brandy in the world is called Louis Trez. And I think it costs, and I might get it wrong, but I think it costs something like 3,000 or 4,000 euros for the cheapest bottle. Okay. So like 60,000 rand.
Okay.
The most expensive, I don't even know because I was too scared to ask. But this is a family business. It's been around for a few hundred years, but basically they mature their whiskies for 100 years.
Sure.
So the whiskey you are making today is probably going to be for 5 generations time. So if you do it wrong today, your family in 5 generations is going to be without a job.
Sure.
So if you think about that mindset, imagine, I mean, you think about the Chinese government that have like a 100-year plan. You know, this is why they've, you know, grown so big. So imagine if every business could even just have a 30-year plan.
Sure.
You would run your business totally different. You'd treat your employees differently. You'd treat your customers differently.
Yeah.
You would do things for long-term sustainability, not for short-term. And I suppose this is my biggest disappointment, having to keep the banks very happy in the short term has meant we haven't been able to have perfect long-term view. But, you know, this is, I think, is just a critical factor. We need to get back into leadership and running companies that, you know, it's not just the shareholders, it's the employees and the customers actually drive the value for our shareholders. It's an outcome. And we really need to do a better job of looking after our employees and looking after our customers, for sure.
And then you reckon with this mindset, will that be enough to root out corruption?
The reality is, as I said earlier, 99% of people just want to do an honest day's living, make a wage, and then look after their families, educate their kids, and have a decent life. It's a small portion who want to do it, but unfortunately, it's those people who get into power. As they say, you know, a fish rots from the head down. And so the most important thing you have to do as a leader is make sure that you are giving the right culture across. You know, for example, if you set up the right systems, I cannot sign a check. I cannot pay anyone physically. I don't have the ability to do it. I don't have the authority in my business to pay anyone. And that's really important because, you know, if I'm the CEO, I can override everything if I want to. But if you set it up that I don't have absolute power, I can't be absolutely corrupted because it's not possible.
That's good.
And so this is what we've done. You just, you know, set up those situations. And yes, sometimes it gets quite frustrating because now I must go and convince other people of my views, and even though I'm the CEO. But actually, it's the best outcome because you get feedback from different people. And then sometimes you have to change your view. That actually, if you get good feedback and you give people accountability, they actually give you warts and all feedback, and you end up with a much better product and not just, I'm going to do my thing because I'm better and cleverer than everyone else. It's a disaster scenario, and we've seen a few of them in South Africa that have ended up in tears.
Sure. How do you make an elephant dance from a culture point of view? Kind of have everyone sort of leave this culture that you're building at your age? And this is not just 100 people. I mean, culture is hard on its own for 200 people size business. How are you doing this for an organization your size, turning around as well as navigating the crisis?
Yeah. It's very difficult and it takes time, but there's a few things. One is you've got to give people clarity. Uh-huh. So they need to know exactly what's required of them. You need to live those values. And then you've got to communicate. The best way to do it is to give people responsibility, because then they can't say, well, someone else told me to do this, or you told me to do it differently. No, I didn't. I haven't told you anything. I've told you this is how you do it. I mean, this is what I want. You decide how you're going to do it.
Yeah.
And if you've got any questions, come and ask. And you're all adults. Treat them like adults.
Uh-huh.
You know, this command and control is really treating adults like children. And that's where you get bad results. And I found people respond very, very well to that. But yes, it does take time. And what you have to do over time is the people that don't like the culture must leave. But if you don't give them the clear view of this is the culture of EOH, they can't make a decision. If you give them a clear view of this is what's expected, they can make a decision. And it's amazing how many people leave on their own steam rather than once you've given them that clarity, because they know if they go outside those boundaries, they're out. And then you have to be absolutely unequivocal. If you overstep the boundary, you're out. End of story. No questions asked, because I was very clear with you.
Yeah.
And then very quickly, you get people in the business that want to be part of that. It's like anything. It gains momentum. And once you get past a certain level, then it becomes de facto. But it's not easy. It's a relentless thing you have to do every single day.
Yeah.
The most important thing about it is that culture is far more important than strategy. Have a good culture, you'll have a good business. If you don't have a good culture, you'll never have a good business. It's probably the most critical point. Some clever guy said once, culture eats strategy for breakfast. I can't remember who it was, but it's the most true thing ever.
So when you started, did you have to let go of the whole exco, or did you keep some members of exco?
Nobody. I promoted, I think, two people because I needed their technology skills.
Yeah.
Three people, actually, and the rest were new. Because I needed people that didn't have any attachment to the past, so that would be open and honest and just sort the trouble out and wouldn't hide anything. And I needed, you know, specific skills that weren't there, especially in the support staff. And so you had to go and find them. Yeah.
So someone would have thought, hey, keep some of the institutional knowledge and all of that. So that didn't bother you.
We were in crisis, remember? The boat was sinking. There was no good leaving a few people on board. Everyone had to get in lifeboats, and, you know, there was no like halfway house here. The best thing was that, you know, when I went to my customers, I could say to them, there's no one running the business today, board and exco, that had anything to do with what happened in the past. They're all gone. It was about what people didn't do. So there were people that I got rid of that had turned blind eyes. They'd been asked by their staff about things and they'd ignored them. And that's just as bad as people who actually do something wrong. Because if you can't trust people to tell you the truth, how do you actually manage them? You can't. Who told me that was Professor Wiseman Kuchlu, who became the chairman of KPMG. I actually knew him, and he had gone through that whole issue before me with KPMG.
Yeah.
And I went to see him. I asked him for a meeting. He gave me a lot of time. He gave me like 2 hours.
Jeez.
And I asked him, what were the things that you wish you had done faster, you know, earlier? And these were some of the things he told me. And so it was quite easy after that, with that knowledge, was to go and actually execute on it, because of, you know, someone of his caliber admitted he made a few mistakes and wish he had done it differently. There was no excuse for me to make the same mistakes as he, you know, again. So I was very lucky, you know, as well.
And personally, when these people go and they leave their access card, how...
Very emotional, very difficult. At the time, you doubt yourself. You know, this is why if you do it on your own, it's very difficult. If you've got people like Michael Katz, Martin Kingston, Prof. Nkuhlu, interestingly, you know, one or two of the ministers that I spoke to, if you've discussed it with them and they've got a view, we had Dr. Makwanazi, who was my chairman at the time, you go and discuss these things with them.
Yeah.
When they've all agreed that you're doing the right thing, even though it's very emotional, you know you're doing the right thing for the business.
Yeah.
And it's not a personal thing. You're doing the best thing for the business. So this is why it's so important to have those conversations.
Wow. And then the criticisms that come, because I imagine even as you're communicating transparently, people have forgotten that you were not involved in the past, and they're still just pointing criticisms at EOH. How do you handle those as a leader?
It is what it is. I know it's going to come. And so you learn not to take things personally. You learn to think about them, take a deep breath, think about what's best for the business.
Yeah.
And some things, you know, are worth fighting. Some things aren't. As they say, you can't please all the people all the time. You've just got to pick your battles and do the important things and not the noisy things. They say, you know, if you're trying to walk from A to B and you stop to throw stones at every dog that barks at you, you'll never, ever reach your destination. So some dogs you just got to ignore.
I love that. So Stephen, I know we're running out of time. I just wonder if you got one or two or three books you could recommend for our listeners.
Well, the one that changed the way I did strategy was a book called Exponential Organizations and by Peter Diamantis. It's a very interesting book, and you must read it with an open mind. It just teaches you to think differently. And to strategize differently. And I think that's been very helpful, because when you've got a big problem, I've learned an ability to look at it in a different way. So that's the first book. The second book that I think is worth interesting, but it's a difficult book to read, is this Nassim Taleb, Fooled by Randomness. It just is very important that you don't wait till the crisis before you start sorting out your problems. Think about your problems first and make sure when you get to the crisis, you're ready. You know, like we all know crises are coming. It's like, you know the enemy's coming, but you're going to wait until they shoot their first shot at you to see how big their guns are. Organize yourself the best you can, so when they start shooting, you're giving your best back immediately. Excellent. And you know, that's a very interesting book. There's lots of them out there, but those two I think have been very interesting for me, you know, dealing with these difficult situations.
Excellent. Stephen, thanks a million. And we wish you well on your journey of the turnaround and navigating the crisis. You're leading an important organization for all of us in this country and beyond.
Thank you very much, and really appreciate your time and the opportunity. It's been fun to chat. Hopefully we do it again soon.
Now that was incredibly awesome. We are so grateful to Stephen for sharing his insights and experience with us so generously, and for recommending those fantastic books, Exponential Organizations and Fooled by Randomness. So tune in once again for another dose of insightful, inspirational and actionable leadership and personal development content, all from African super leaders. Remember to subscribe on our website or iTunes or Deezer or Spotify podcast channels, and also to follow us on our social media pages on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter and on LinkedIn. Until then, go out there and super lead.